Well, we are beginning today our study of panentheism, and what we're going to do with this is we are going to look at really two broad worldviews. We're going to look at Buddhism along with panentheism, but you have to remember that they are not the same thing.
Okay.
Many of Buddha's insights are taken over by the panentheists and used to construct their understanding of God. So Buddhism is really a form of atheistic spirituality, if that even makes sense. Because Buddha said there is no God. And this is what a lot of people don't even really understand about Buddhism, that it's giving you a spiritual outlook sans any accountability to a creator. And that's actually one of the reasons why it's so appealing. But it's also full proof that all the religions of the world can't be true. Some religions of the world, at least, are false, because if Buddha goes around saying there is no God, and if Jesus said, as the Gospels record him saying, that God is the most important thing you can pursue, then one of those guys are wrong.
The people that say all roads lead to one.
It's impossible. The laws of logic dictate that either all religions are false, or only one is true. So the idea that you can bring Buddhism and Christianity together, the only way you can do that is if you just ignore what the founders of those faiths said, which is to do those faiths a huge disservice. So what is panentheism? Some people say it's just pantheism with the N in the middle. But pan means all, of course. N means in. And then theos or theism refers to God. So panentheism is the idea that says that everything is in God or contributes to God's nature, and God in turn contributes to everything else. God is in the universe kind of like the soul is in the body. And just as the soul is affected by what goes on in its body, so also God is affected by what goes on in the universe. The universe is evolving and God is evolving. So God is a process. That's why panentheists are often called process theists or process theologians. Some have referred to process theism as bipolar theism because its best thinkers have asserted that God has two poles or dimensions to his nature, an actual pole that is finite and a potential pole that is infinite. In short, God is potentially infinite. For all eternity, he will evolve and become more and more perfect, powerful, knowledgeable, and so forth. He is also actually finite. In the moment, God is limited by time, space, and the free wills of his creatures. This view is also called co-relativism, for on this model of reality, God is relativized by the universe and vice versa. Okay? Now, it is generally agreed that the roots of process thought are found in Buddhism. And so I guess it's best if we digress into the life of the Buddha. Have you ever heard anything about Buddhism? Have you studied anything about him?
No. Not beyond basic knowledge. I kind of have an idea of who he was and his life. Siddhartha Gautama,
Siddhartha Gautama. Or sometimes people just say Gautama Buddha. Buddha is really a title. Buddha is a title, kind of like Christ is a title. It's not like Christ is Jesus' last name. And a lot of people think that. Well, that's not true. Buddha was not really the given name of the person we call the Buddha. Buddha is a title meaning enlightened one. And it's a title that Siddhartha earned through his search for truth. This is a religion that I very seriously thought about converting to. I sat in a class. I was actually getting really frustrated with Christians in particular. But then there were things that I was learning about the Bible that disturbed me morally. I was kind of getting really, anxious about a lot of the stuff. And I studied under a guy who to this day is one of the greatest teachers I've ever studied under. And he was a Catholic who converted to Buddhism. And we spent the first part of I was on trimesters. This is dating me. I was when I went to the last college or one of the last colleges in the country that was on the quarter system. It was a great system though because we took 3 classes per quarter instead of 5 classes per semester, and I could really get into these classes. That was a full time load. And I took, I was a religion major, so I took, and I also majored in history, so I took this course on hermeneutics, and we spent the first half of the course on Christian hermeneutics, and we spent the second half of the course on Buddhist hermeneutics, and that's when I was introduced to this Buddhist worldview. And I was blown away, and there was an internal consistency to the system that really very much intrigued me, and I said, hey, I can be spiritual, and I don't have to have God, and I don't have to go around telling people that they're wrong, and this is really great. It's so freeing. And so for a couple of weeks, I experienced what I would consider to be sort of a crisis of decision, like, yeah, maybe I should do this, you know. Maybe I should really just go ahead and do this. And then, of course, it subsided. And some of the reasons it subsided, I will be sharing with you here today. But Siddhartha is born, he was born around 560 BC, 6th century BC, see. So another indicator of the importance of the century. He's the son of Suddhodana, the king of the Sakyas. His mother is named Maya, interestingly enough. She will die soon after he's born. And when he's young, his father decided that his son has to live in such a way that he never experiences suffering. So he arranged for him to live in the upper stories of the palace without access to the ground. And the palace was as brilliant as that of Shiva on Mount Kailasi. Soft music came from the gold-edged tambourines which the women tapped with their fingertips, and they danced as beautifully as the choicest heavenly nymphs. They were nymphos. And they entertained him with soft words, tremulous calls, wanton sayings, sweet laughter, butterfly kisses, and seductive glances. And so he became captive of these women, who were well-versed in the subject of sensuous enjoyment and indefatigable in sexual pleasure. And it did not occur to him to come down from the palace. Why would it? He's having sex with all these women all the time. He's living the dream. At the age of 16. Just as many people who, in reward for their virtues, live in a palace in heaven, are content to remain there and have no desire to descend to the earth. Why would I want to leave this place? I'm getting everything I want or need. Strangely, Siddhartha will get married as a teenager. And you have to understand these dates are rough figures. It could have been as late as 17 or 18. But in either somewhere in 16, 17 or 18, he gets married to Yashodhara.
What's the text called where these are originating from?
These are the sutras. Okay. Yeah, and there are also other traditions that are alongside of them, but the Buddhist scriptures are called the sutras. And he actually has a son. His son's name is Rahula. On several occasions, the women of the palace told Siddhartha about the beautiful groves just outside the city, and Siddhartha, feeling like an elephant locked inside his house, that was a description given to him in one of the scriptures, decided to make a journey outside the palace. And so, you have to understand, he's hearing these stories of these women, and he goes, you know, I've never really been outside of the palace. I've never seen my own city. I've never done anything. And so this becomes a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy, because one of the stories has it that at birth, an old prophet, an old Hindu prophet, Hinduism is the religion of Nepal, where Buddha is growing up, and this prophet says he will be a great teacher. And his father says, no, he will be a king. When he gets old, he can be a teacher. And the prophet says, well, you can't defy the will of the gods. You know, they're gonna do what they want to do with this young lad. And so, one of the reasons why Suddhodana wants to keep his son in the palace and safe, he doesn't want him to go out and venture and hear new ideas, but he also doesn't want his son to suffer. And so, I mean, Siddhartha literally does not know anything about suffering. He spends his day playing games, having sex with multiple women, probably before and after marriage, and just is living this great life and having fun. And he does journey outside of the city only to go to another palace, depending on the seasons. So this is guy who's just really living it up, and he has never hurt. He might experience soreness from playing a really tough game. He might get tackled or something, but besides those kinds of injuries, he's never experienced anything like suffering. So the king hears of the plans of his dearly beloved son, and he arranges a pleasure excursion which would be worthy of his own affection and royal dignity as well as his son's youth. But he gave orders that all the common folk with any kind of affliction should be kept away from the royal road because he feared that they might agitate the prince's sensitive mind. Very gently, all cripples were driven away, and all those who were crazy, aged, ailing, and the like, and all wretched beggars. So the royal highway became supremely magnificent. Now, there are different versions of the story. The version I'm reciting here is one where he takes three excursions. Some condense it to just one excursion. Some have the gods visiting him and showing him visions on the excursion. Some have a servant who explains things to him. So the movie that you're going to watch will be the one where he just takes one excursion and he sees three things. Some will say he took three excursions. But the whole point is this. He takes this excursion and he sees old people. You know, they kind of wander into the city. Or maybe the gods open his eyes to them just beyond the crowd. And he's like, what is that? What? They look weird. And the servant says, these are people that are old, my lord. Old? What is that? And so he learns for the first time that there's a thing called old age. And you're going to get older and older, and you're going to get weaker and weaker. And your metabolism's going to slow down, and you're going to gain weight no matter how you like it. When I graduated from high school, I was 165 pounds. I could not gain a pound. Now I cannot lose a pound. I was limping through the house not long ago, and my wife says, what's the matter? Are you sore? And I said, yes. She goes, what did you do? I said, I took a nap. So my 40s are killing me. And I still have, hopefully, a long way to go. But, I mean, the older you get, I mean, you start to feel it when you're 40. I mean, you just can't go out and run like you used to when you were a teenager. And Buddha didn't know this. I mean, I used to hear my dad complain about it all the time. I just didn't understand. I was 16, you know. I'd be like, what's wrong with this guy? Now I know. So then he gets, some people say, well, he leaves the parade, and that's the movie. The movie's going to have Keanu Reeves as Buddha. Leave the parade and go. But at some point, whether he leaves the parade or just goes on another excursion, the next vision he gets is sickness. And the servant or the god explains, hey, look, nobody will ever pass through this life without at least once getting sick. And he's like, show me sickness. And so he goes and he visits people that are just very, 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 very sick. They can't move, you know, and he learns what a disease is. And he freaks out over this. And then the next vision, of course, is death. At some point in your existence, you are going to die. You are going to die. The person that you call yourself will end. And Buddha never knew this. He never knew anything about death. And he goes and he sees a funeral, and he just weeps and cries and doesn't understand. And at the very bottom of page 82, I give a quotation of Siddhartha. And this is I love this quotation because it's a great summary of our own culture. "This is the end," he says, "which has been fixed for all, and yet the world forgets its fears and takes no heed. The hearts of men are surely hardened to fears, for they feel quite at ease even while traveling along the road to the next life. How could an intelligent person pay no heed at a time of disaster when he knows of his impending destruction?" It's amazing what the human psyche does in the face of death. Have you ever seen a group of people right after somebody dies? You will witness the death of someone close to you or someone you at least know, and you will get to watch sort of almost like as through a window how people react. And you might be a part of the reaction, but they will immediately begin to occupy themselves with minutiae. Minutiae meaning just the tedious, petty things surrounding what we're going to do now. They will occupy themselves with how we're going to dress this person for the funeral and calling the funeral people and getting them to come and who we're going to call and who we're going to talk to and what arrangements are going to be made. And they just immerse themselves in this, and they don't spend any time reflecting on what has actually just happened. Why? The human psyche can't handle this. It's a psychological reaction to the way people handle death. And this is why a lot of religious traditions have a set of mourning rituals to help you deal with this. Because if you don't deal with it in a healthy way, the mourning will actually be prolonged indefinitely. Whenever you see someone die, very few people will get in a reflective mood and contemplate the meaning of this person's life, meaning of my life, where we actually go when we die. And everybody just wants to say, well, this person's off in a better place or whatever. But they don't really ask the question, is that true? It used to be that death was always around us. In the 19th century, for example, if you were in a middle class to upper class home, there was a room in your home called the parlor. And what was the parlor? Whenever a loved one died, that's where you put the loved one for several days waiting for the actual time of the funeral. And that corpse might be there for a week. And that was the parlor. And people would come to the parlor to give a last visitation. You may bury this guy at your church, or you might bury your grandmother at a cemetery. But, you know, not all cemeteries are actually a modern phenomenon. So, you know, what you did with the body afterwards was kind of determined by your village, your county, and the laws and all that stuff surrounding it. But little children saw grandma get sick. They saw grandma get very weak. They saw grandma die. They would be sitting at the bed, and they would watch their grandmother die. And then they would see her get carted over to the parlor. They would see people cleaning her. And so interspersed between her going in inside, outside, and playing was her dealing with this fact that you too, little girl, you're going to go through this journey too, and you will actually find yourself on a bed, and you're going to die, and your granddaughter, if you're lucky to live that long, you will have a granddaughter that watches all this too. And this is just the way of life. And so little children dealt with it by singing songs like "Ring Around the Rosie," "Pocket Full of Posies," "Ashes, Ashes, We All Fall Down." Well, those are the stages of the plague. That little nursery rhyme was written by children or made up by children to psychologically deal with the plague. Well, what do we do now? We don't have parlors anymore. We changed the parlor to a living room. And we cart our old people off to an old folks' home.
It's called the living room.
It's now called the living room. And we cart the old we cart our old people to a nursing home, and we barely you barely see like if your loved one dies in a nursing home, you see the death maybe, and you were with that person for just a few moments, and then some doctors in sanitized suits come and they take that corpse away, and it's just out, it's done. And you may have a visitation where you go see them all made up and prettied up in a casket, and then they're buried, and then that's it. And, you know, in the white communities in the South, we bury our dead within 3 days. In the black community, it usually takes a week. But whether it's a week or 3 days, I mean, it's all sanitized now. And so you don't actually really deal with death all of your life. Death is just death. We hear, oh, somebody died. Oh, that sucks. And then you just go on. And so our culture is exactly like Buddha is describing. We all just sort of go about our way, and we don't really think about it until we hear someone die. We're like, oh. We also have this thing now where people get attached to famous people who die because they don't really have any real attachments in the real world because of the internet. And so last year was the worst year ever. Why? Because all these famous people died. Well, you didn't know any of those people. You didn't know Prince. You didn't know David Bowie. You didn't know Princess Leia, Carrie Fisher. I mean, you didn't know them. Now, I'm sad that they died, of course. I don't want them to die. But, I mean, you don't. I mean, these people are crying on YouTube over a person they never knew. But they never go visit their grandmother in the nursing home. This is our culture. Not long after seeing these visions, Siddhartha is so overcome with grief. He's so overcome with the situation that he leaves his palace. He leaves his wife and son, and he goes out to find the answer. And so for 6 years, he travels about meeting religious teachers, studying their doctrines, and following their practices. Now, this journey is taken when he's about 29. So Rahula was probably born 10 years or so after Buddha gets married. And then he leaves.
16, so
26. Yeah, so if it's 16, it would be 13 years. And if he's 19 when he gets married, it's 10 years. But he's married for a while, and then he has a son. And the way the movie portrays it, it's his son is born the very night that he decides to leave. In any case, he leaves, and he is not satisfied by any of the religious teachers that he comes into contact with. There are theistic teachers that he meets, and he rejects theism. There are pantheistic teachers that he meets, and he rejects pantheism. And so he abandons all religious traditions, and he sets out to develop his own path to escape suffering. And so on a particular evening at the age of 35, while sitting under a tree on the bank of the Naranjara River, he attains enlightenment. And I'm about to explain to you what he experiences at the Bo tree, but the point is that at that point, that's when he becomes the Buddha. And then he spends the rest of his life, 45 years, teaching men and women how to follow the same path. He recognized no differences of caste or social groupings, and the way he preached was open to all men and women who were ready to understand and follow it. And at the age of 80, he seems to have died of food poisoning. It's a very ignominious death. And his parting words seem to be, at least as we understand them, Buddhas do but point the way, work out your salvation with diligence. And that's pretty much the life of the Buddha. Questions about that? Go ahead.
No, I don't think so.
Two major schools of thought rise after his death. Theravada Buddhism is what we're going to focus on because that really is the teaching of the elders. It's the one that is closest to what Buddha himself taught. And the other school is Mahayana Buddhism. It means the great vehicle. And that is the one that actually opens itself up to metaphysics and more traditional religious type practices. There's another view of Buddhism called Zen Buddhism. We alluded to it when we talked about pantheism, and it said that you can attain enlightenment through a flash of insight. And so Zen Buddhists will focus on cones or koans, as they're sometimes pronounced, but a cone is just a nonsensical statement like the sound of one hand clapping. And by focusing on the absurd, I might get a flash of insight. But a Zen Buddhist will say just any experience could give you enlightenment. You have to just be open to it. As I say, we're gonna focus on Theravada. The teachings of the Buddha, called sutras, were passed down orally until they were first written down 400 years after his death. I recall a conversation with my college hermeneutics professor, who was a Buddhist, who told me that it was really not all that important if any of the sutras can be traced back to the Buddha himself. What is really important is the truths which the sutras try to convey. About 70 of our manuscripts may be confidently assigned to the 5th century AD, and for the next 200 years or so, the output continues steadily to increase. The great majority of these early manuscripts are copies of Buddhist sutras that happened to be in particular favor at the time. And during the following period, when the Tunyang district passed temporarily under the Tibetan rule, the flow of Buddhist literature rapidly dried up and never returned to anything like its earlier level. So that's the history in a nutshell. The next question is, what does Buddhism teach? And what you need to know about Buddhism is it teaches four noble truths. The first one is dukkha, samudaya. The second noble truth is samudaya. The third noble truth is nirodha. And the fourth noble truth is magga. So what are these? The first noble truth, dukkha, is usually translated suffering. And as I said before, the whole point of Buddhism is to get rid of all suffering. Let's deal with this thing, issue called suffering, and try to overcome it. And so the first noble truth is that life is suffering. But it's a little bit more complex than that. While Paulo Rahula says this at the bottom of page 84, it is admitted that the term dukkha and the first noble truth contains, quite obviously, the ordinary meaning of suffering. But in addition, it also includes deeper ideas such as imperfection, impermanence, emptiness, insubstantiality. It is difficult, therefore, to find one word to embrace the whole conception of the term dukkha as the first noble truth, and so it is better to leave it untranslated than to give an inadequate and wrong idea of it by conveniently translating it as suffering or pain. Okay. Now, there are three aspects to this suffering, impermanence, pain that you experience in life. The first is ordinary suffering, old age, sickness, and death. The second aspect to dukkha is change. That's why it's called impermanence. This occurs when one goes from a state of happiness to sadness or pleasure to suffering. This is unavoidable. Why? Because all is impermanent. And that is the heart of Buddhism. All is impermanent. All is dukkha. Nothing is everlasting. Everything changes. Now, let me ask you this. If everything changes, if nothing is permanent, then can there be a God?
Everything changes. Nothing is everlasting. I mean, I don't think that it says that there can't be a God, because there can be a God that is
constantly changing
and not everlasting.
Right. So, but can the theistic God exist in this worldview? The unchanging God of the Bible, for example.
If you could say monotheism, maybe there is one God, but at the heart of theism, which we haven't gotten into yet, but I believe you know, the pillars basically is that yes, it's an unchanging, everlasting God. So no.
Yeah. So theism cannot be true if this is correct, right? So it's not just that God doesn't exist if Buddhism is true. If this noble truth is true, then theism cannot be true. The third form of suffering, or dukkha, is known as the conditioned states, and that leads us to an analysis of the five aggregates. Now, this is really interesting. Buddha actually just believed that you were made up of five aggregates, or there are five aspects to what you are. And one of the questions we might have to ask is, what is his epistemology? And I'll hold that off for just a second. The first aggregate is matter, made up of the traditional elements of solidity, fluidity, heat, and motion. And then there are also derivatives of these great elements, which is our five material sense organs, eye, ear, nose, tongue, and their corresponding objects in the material world, visible form, sound, odor, taste, and tangible things, as well as some thoughts or ideas or conceptions which are in the sphere of mind objects. Hence, all of matter, internal and external, is included in the aggregate of matter. So that's the first part of you. The first part of you is just straight up matter. Now, given what I just said here, can you kind of guess what his epistemology is? Is he an empiricist or is he a rationalist? Empiricist is someone who says that all knowledge begins in the senses, and a rationalist says all knowledge begins in the mind. If he's going to focus on this first aggregate, what would you think?
I mean, you would think empiricist first off, but then I think to compose this or have this knowledge, wouldn't you have to be a rationalist?
Well, that's an interesting point, but I think that if I were to sit down with Buddha and explain to him the debate between Aristotle and Plato, I think Buddha would clearly go with Aristotle. Rationalists usually focus on the unchanging and the eternal. And because he's fully embraced the principle of dukkha or impermanence, he's letting his senses be his guide.
Okay.
The second aggregate is sensations, and that includes all of our physical and mental sensations, and our experience through matter. The third aggregate is that of perceptions, which are produced by contact with the world, and these perceptions recognize whether or not objects are physical or mental. And the fourth is the aggregate of mental formations, and that group includes good and bad volitional activities. Perception and sensation are not volitional, for they do not produce karmic debt, only volitional actions, such as attention, will, determination, and so forth, can produce karmic debt. So basically, you're living this life, you bring in your information, at this point you're not responsible, but what you do with that information at that point will produce your karmic debt. And then finally, the aggregate of mental consciousness, which is connected to the other faculties. The eye, for example, is the basis for the awareness of a visible form as an object of sight or visual consciousness. It must be repeated here, says Walpala Rahula, that according to the Buddhist philosophy, there's no permanent, unchanging spirit which can be considered self or soul or ego as opposed to matter, and that consciousness should not be taken as a spirit in opposition to matter. This point has to be emphasized because a wrong notion that consciousness is a sort of self or soul that continues as a permanent substance through life has persisted from the earliest times to the present day. Now, that's very important. The Hindu says Atman, self, and Atman is Brahman. The Buddha says Anatman, no self.
Okay.
You are caught up in impermanence. This is a process metaphysic. This is a non-substantial metaphysic. There are no things in my experience. They're just events. Okay. Now, the five aggregates are dukkha. There is no self which stands behind these aggregates experiencing dukkha. As Buddhaghosa once said, mere suffering exists, but no sufferer is found. The deeds are, but no doer is found. Now, this is very important because we're trying to solve the problem here. Why are you suffering? Why is this happening?
And they're saying there is no suffering. So it is no, in other words, it doesn't originate from anything.
Right. Now, once you say there's no self to suffer, the cause of suffering is precisely the idea that you are a substantial self. Egoism, or egotism, whichever word you want to use, is the cause of your suffering. And that's what samudaya, we're talking about the arise of the origin of dukkha. The cause of the origin of dukkha does not arise from outside of dukkha, but from within. So the cause of your problem is you, and therefore the solution is you.
But there's no self, so what is you?
Well, that raises other questions. Good for you. You have good philosophical intuitions here. But just go with this for a minute. We're just doing exposition, right? Dukkha arises out of the false notion of self and its attending thirst or desire. Right? That's how dukkha comes about. The thirst to satisfy a self that does not exist, produces suffering. Four nutriments are the preconditions for continuity of existence: food, contact between sense organs and the material world, consciousness, and mental volition. The last nutriment includes the will to live, to exist, to become more and more. It is the root of selfish desire. It is the cause of dukkha. Volition, along with its attendant good and bad effects, is karma. Good actions produce good effects. Bad actions produce bad effects. The desire to exist produces the continuance of karma. The fourth nutriment corresponds to the aggregate of mental formations which survives the body after death. Now, here's the point. Here's the point. You have five aggregates. The fourth one is your mental formations which produce your actions. That's what survives your death. Have you ever asked this question to those who believe in reincarnation? If we're being reincarnated, why don't I remember it?
Yeah, that's
fine. The Buddha has an answer. The fourth aggregate is the only thing that survives. There is no you to remember. It's a part of you that moves on into the next life. And so if you spent your days hunting animals, you will probably be reincarnated into an animal that hunts other things. So I was told by my Buddhist professor that because I like to go quail hunting, I'll be reincarnated as a cheetah. But it's not an I, as if I have some spirit that is consciously aware that moves from the body that you see here to the body of a cheetah. That's the wrong understanding of reincarnation. The quote-unquote I that becomes the cheetah is really just a part of the I, an I that doesn't exist, right? A fourth aggregate, the mental formations that has built up all this karmic debt, and it spills over into this new form here. Now, you're going to watch the movie. I'm going to go ahead and do a spoiler for you. The movie that you're about to watch is a movie about a monk that's searching for his master. His master has died, and he wants to find the incarnation of his master. There are three candidates for who's going to be the master. And the three candidates are these three children that exist in different parts of the world. It turns out that the monk is incarnated in all three of the children. Now, how is that possible? It's possible because in the Buddhist conception of reincarnation, it's not you that is incarnated. It's not like you have this indivisible spirit that can't be broken, that just goes from body to body. It's an aggregate of you that's incarnated. Now, just kind of sock that away for a minute. But that's kind of what's going on here. That's how they get around the issue of why don't I remember my incarnations if I'm constantly being reincarnated?
Sure. Well, I haven't heard that explanation before, which is good, because I always felt like, well, that's convenient that you're reincarnated and have no knowledge of your past lives or how many times you've been reincarnated.
Yeah, when I was listening to this for the first time myself, I was like, that's very interesting. I mean, I've never heard that, like you. And that proves that Buddha was this whole thing is genius. There's an internal coherency here. But once you accept the presuppositions, many of these things just follow.
We may get to this, but to me, what contains these aggregates? What is the structure because if there is no self, what holds these aggregates together?
Your body.
Our body, but
you're an event in time, you are an event in time, and at death, what you are just sort of breaks up. You might as well ask what holds your hands together. I mean, you have cells in your body that's held together. What keeps that there? Well, if the same answer as the five aggregates. The five aggregates are held together just by biological laws and physics and so forth.
Yeah, and this whole idea, dukkha, arises out of the false notion of self. Well, how can there be a notion of self if there is no self? And then following that, a thirst to satisfy self. Why would there be a thirst?
How could there be a notion of God if there is no God? We can deceive ourselves into believing things that just aren't. There is no God, right? So there is no self. There's no all the things that you think are real just aren't. And
that's what causes dukkha. And that's what
it's saying. Your problem and my problem, everybody's problem, is that I go through life and I keep feeding myself. I keep feeding this ego, thinking that it's so important. And it's not even real. And so the reason I'm constantly unhappy is because I'm constantly feeding an illusion. Have you ever met somebody that just isn't in touch with reality? Why are some rich people the most miserable people you've ever met? Because they're not really in touch with reality. They're not even really in touch with who they are. Well, what Buddha is saying is the clearest truth to come to is that there is no they to be in touch with. And so if you fully embrace that and live that out, you'll actually be a very happy person. That's why all the images of Buddha that you see are images of a very fat guy that's smiling, happy Buddha. That doesn't mean that he was himself fat. It just meant he was satisfied with his life.
And so what it's saying then is that you have to come to this realization that even though we have this kind of innate desire for a self, that you become enlightened when you realize that self does not exist.
Mm-hmm.
And that is how you erase suffering, or at least one element of suffering.
Exactly. Okay. So here we are at Nirodha. The third noble truth is the cessation of dukkha. And it comes when all desires cease. The cessation of dukkha is nirvana, enlightenment. Nirvana is the annihilation of the illusion of the false idea of self, which gave rise to desire in the first place. Nirvana is absolute truth, and the absolute truth is that all is relative and permanent and changing. Once one has realized nirvana, one's good deeds are of the purest sort, for he no longer has any thought of self. What is Christian morality? It's the carrot stick morality. A carrot stick is held in front of you, and you're just chasing it. And Jesus, unfortunately, gave you a false teaching because he has actually bought into this false idea of self. And so you're doing good deeds to get to heaven. See how you're still feeding yourself? You need to get rid of all that and just be. And just go with the flow.
Okay, would this assume then, though, that...
Let me finish the point. He has no longer any thought of self. He is free from the illusion of self and the thirst for becoming. And so how does dukkha cease? And that's where we get to the Eightfold Path. Go ahead and ask your question.
Well, I was going to say, does this assume that humans are inherently good? You have to reach...
You're inherently neutral.
Inherently neutral.
Yeah.
Okay.
Obviously, there would be no original sin in a Buddhist worldview. They would reject that outright.
But what about the child that is obviously, and I've never had children, but I think it's evidenced that the child that is born is inherently born selfish and born with a desire to...
Oh, you're looking at the recipient of a lot of karmic debt. Yeah, the Buddhist can answer that question quite easily. Why does the child have those propensities? Because that child had those propensities in a previous incarnation. Mm-hmm. And is suffering the karmic debt of that previous incarnation.
So every child has that?
Yeah, we're all born. You and I have lived this life many times. In fact, one version of Buddhism embraces the myth of the eternal return, kind of like, you know, Brahman falls asleep and he dreams and he wakes up and he falls back asleep. That's why we have deja vu. One version of Buddhism would embrace the myth of the eternal return. Nietzsche talked about it. The universe can only exist in a finite number of ways, and so every so trillions of years, the universe kind of comes into the form it is now, and that's why you and I reappear, and we feel like we've been here before. So even certain atheists have had this idea. That's why Woody Allen said, "Oh, great, I get to watch the Ice Capades again." It was a funny line in one of his movies. He was talking about the myth of the eternal return. Well, one version of Buddhism would say that the only reason you and I are the only ones in this room is because you and I haven't been in nirvana. Billions and trillions of years ago, all these pews were filled, and these classes were being taught, and maybe I was sitting in the audience with you. And all those people attain nirvana, and you and I are left. We haven't made it yet. We haven't found out the right way to live yet. And so that's why we're here. But once dukkha ceases, it ceases when all desires to feed the monster, the self, when those desires totally cease, the cycle of samsara, of birth, life, death, rebirth, that cycle that you're on is going to be over, and you will perish into oblivion. But that's great, right? Because that's the whole point. Existence is suffering. Is reincarnation a good thing?
Not according to that model.
No, it's a curse. And this is what's really sad. American New Agers look at reincarnation as this really cool thing. Like when you watch the movie, Bridget Fonda and Chris Isaacs, the country singer, who does not a very good job acting in this, they are like, boy, it'd be really great to be... Boy, I mean, reincarnation just seems like such a cool idea. No, it's not. The Eastern looks at it as a curse. It is not good. It's the myth of Sisyphus squared, cubed, multiplied a million times. You're just rolling the stone up the hill only to find yourself back all over again. It's
more than that, you have no memory of it. So it doesn't,
to
say it's cool is an arbitrary statement because...
But yeah. It's horrible.
There's no remembrance. Maybe if you came back in another life and you remember what you had learned, but it's like it's a constant resetting of the movie. So it's.
Oh yeah.
I don't understand what would be cool about that.
There's nothing cool
to remember about it.
There's nothing cool about it. The Easterner hates reincarnation. This is not good news. And so, what Buddha is offering you is an escape. From reincarnation, escape into nirvana. And it's not like Hinduism where I yoke with Brahman and I'm pulled out of it for a while and then for some reason my soul cascades back down into the cycle. This is a full escape. That's what's so great about it. It's full redemption. Okay, the way that leads to the cessation of dukkha. The way that leads to the cessation of dukkha is also called the middle path. Because it avoids two extremes. One extreme is the hedonist who searches for pleasure all of his life. And the other extreme is the asceticism, where you shun all pleasure. You don't enjoy your life at all. And Buddha says you have to avoid those extremes because he himself has lived those extremes. He grew up in a palace, and then he lived 5 years or so as an ascetic, and he realized that both paths just don't work. And you'll see this interesting scene in the movie where he looks out of the river and he sees a musician teaching a student how to play a stringed instrument, and he says, if you tighten the string too much, it'll break, but if you loosen it too much, it won't play. And as a guitar player, you can appreciate that. There's a middle way, a middle strength of tightening that string to make the sound you want. And if you don't follow that path, you will not attain nirvana. And so this is the Eightfold Path. And it's actually easy to remember Visa Limp. So you just say right vision, intention or thought, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. And just to kind of illustrate how this works, I always like to focus on the right concentration one. It's a really good one. I look at my students all the time and I say, why is it that all of you suffer? Well, because you never concentrate on where you are. Remember what Yoda said to Luke Skywalker? A long time ago, I watched this one. All his life, while he looked away into the horizon, never his mind on where he was and what he was doing. And that is the average teenager. Especially now with cell phones. You're never in the moment. You're never living in the moment. What does the average person do when they go to a concert? They have to hold up their cell phone and say, look, world, look at me. I'm on Facebook and I'm at this concert. You don't even enjoy the concert because you're too busy sending messages to people to try to show them what you're doing, to make them jealous while they're sitting at home and they're not doing anything. But you're not enjoying the concert. You just wasted money. You could just watch a concert on YouTube. My students never immerse themselves in their reading. And they're always daydreaming while they read. And so reading becomes a chore. And my students come to school and they're like, I really wish it was 3 so I could leave school. And at 3:15, they really wish they could be somewhere else than sports. You know, I want to get out of school and just go ahead and go to basketball practice. Well, then I'm at basketball practice and I just want to go home and eat. And they're at home and eat and they get on the phone with whoever and they really wish they could be with their girlfriend. Well, then they sneak out of the house and they go see their girlfriend and they're hanging out with her. But then they kind of wish they could go to that party. I wish it was Friday night so that we can go ahead and go to the party. And Friday night comes, is the party all that great? No, it's not all that great. This sucks. Kids get really excited for homecoming. It's a month away. Now it's a week away. I can't wait. And then homecoming comes. And I go up to them at the dance. You having fun? No, this sucks. I can't wait till this is over so we can go to the party afterwards. They're constantly looking into the future for their fulfillment. And when that future arises, they're present, they're never fulfilled. But have you ever immersed yourself in something? Have you ever immersed yourself in a project, like you play instrument? Have you ever really just gotten into your playing? It's very satisfying.
It is.
Have you ever just immersed yourself into a book? It's that experience is very satisfying. If you fully concentrate on the moment and lose yourself, you see, in the moment, then it becomes sort of a stream of consciousness that is so satisfying. Well, that's the whole point of Buddhism. You lose yourself in this moment. And when you do it, you will actually be happy because you're not worried about the future all the time. You'll just take it as it comes. And you're not longing for the future either because you're living in the moment. We have all these people with all these things and they're so unhappy. Why? Because they're so all constantly wishing the future were here. And, you know, I want to say to your average teenager, don't wish for that. Don't wish that the future was here. That's me. Look at me. I'm old or I'm getting older. So you don't want the future to be here. You want to live in the moment. One will notice in all of this that dukkha, the heart of Buddhist teaching, involves the notion that all is in process. All is continually becoming. So one can see the connection between process theism and Buddhism. Both have given up the notion that there's anything like a substance that is unchanging and eternal. All must pass away. All is changing. Furthermore, there's no real self that undergoes change. There's no continuing I that endures through time. In short, there are no substances. There are only events. Recall the words of Buddhaghosa. Mere suffering exists, but no sufferer is found. The deeds are, but no doer is found. So let's look at process theology with that in mind. And what process theology is, it's really taking Plato and his understanding of the eternal, the ideas that are up here, and Buddhism, which is always talking about change and process. The West had their version of Buddha, Heraclitus. You can never step in the same river twice, right? Because all is flowing, all is changing. And so instead of Parmenides, what is, Heraclitus says, what is becoming. You know, so all is changing, and they kind of brought these together. And for the process theist, God's potential is Plato's eternal forms. That in that realm, the realm of idea, God has this potential. But actually, God is changing and moving forward. And so is the universe. So God is trying to help the universe evolve, and the universe is trying to help God evolve. And it's just this one big system of interdependence. The panentheist, Charles Hartshorne, says, as the subtlest Buddhist for deep spiritual reasons insisted, there is no simply identical self reaping rewards and punishments. Each momentary agent and sufferer is numerically new, from which it flows that I now act, that the I which now act can receive either reward or punishment. I'm going to repeat that. From which it follows that I which now act can never, or never can, receive either reward or punishment beyond the intrinsic reward or punishment of acting and experiencing as it now does. The account is immediately closed. Anything one demands for the future is demanded for another, even though the other is termed oneself. It is this basic insight that no substances exist which endure through time that is the heart of process philosophy. If there are no enduring substances, then God himself cannot be an enduring and unchanging substance. Rather, God himself is constantly changing and even becomes a new being altogether as he enters into new experiences. Or as Alfred North Whitehead, the father of process thought, put it, he says, that all things flow is the first vague generalization which the unsystematized, barely analyzed intuition of men has produced. And therefore, God is not to be treated as an exception to all metaphysical principles invoked to save their collapse. He is their chief exemplification. So if I look in the world and I see change and flux and all that, God is the chief exemplification of that. He's not the exception to that.
Or the cause.
Or the cause of that, except maybe as a director of moving it in a direction. But he's not the cause of the flow and the change itself.
So, in other words, so you've got this timeline rolled up saying he hits start, the timeline rolls, and
no,
so be it.
Not at all. No. The universe is eternal.
Okay.
And God, because the universe is God's body.
Is God eternal then?
God has always existed along with the universe.
But I thought he can't be enduring and unchanging.
In the sense that what he is yesterday is not what he is today. But he has been always evolving from all eternity, evolving with the universe. And the universe has always been around. There was no first moment, right? In other words, our first metaphysical intuition is that things change, and therefore the only proper conception of God is one in which the divine himself participates in such change. According to Whitehead, God has two natures, one that is potential, and that is his primordial nature, and refers to what God could be if he were to be actualized. And then another, which is concrete or actual, and that's his consequent nature, and refers to all that God is becoming as he experiences the world. I'm going to not quote him. I'm not going to read that quotation. If you just flip the page over on page 90, I give the translation. There is in the mind of God concepts or ideas which express all that God could be. That's his primordial nature. How do the ideals of God obtain in reality? Through experience. It is by experience that God is able to realize his own potential. It is through experience that God is able to become everything that his mind tells him he is able to become.
So what's the difference between God and us? Is there a difference?
There's only a difference in degree. Because he's metaphysically the same as us.
Well, what is the what is that degree? Or why can't I be God?
You will be God in the sense that your memory will be absorbed in him, and that will contribute to his nature. But you cannot be this thing that's been sort of evolving from all eternity, because the event that I call you, it's just one aspect of the universe that had a beginning and will have an end and will be absorbed into the flow of things as we move along. It's, yeah, in that sense, it's different than pantheism, right? Unfortunately, there is no such thing as an infinite experience. Experiences are short, brief, and limiting. And so while God has the potential to become infinite, he will always be finite. There will always be more of him in his primordial nature than what is realized in the consequent nature. None of this would be possible if God did not have a conceptual scheme that inspires him. None of this would be possible if God was not able to realize his own potential in the world of concrete experience. God needs the world to realize his potential, and the world needs God for its ideals, as well as its ground for order and harmony. In the words of Whitehead, it is as true to say that God creates the world as if the world creates God. And the theme of cosmology, which is the basis of all religions, the story of the dynamic effort of the world passing into everlasting unity, and of the static majesty of God's vision, accomplishing its purpose of completion by absorption of the world's multiplicity of effort. Here's some differences in panentheism. There's an empirical and rational approach. Geiser notes the following. He says, process panentheism has taken two main courses since Whitehead. The empirical, represented by Lohmer, Bernard Malin, and Henry Wieman, and the rational, championed by Hartshorne, Cobb, and Ogden. Hartshorne defends his bipolar theism by way of the ontological argument, in contrast to the more empirically grounded approach of Whitehead. Hartshorne's argument goes something like this. All thoughts refer to something either actual or possible. God is at least possible, but God's existence is not merely possible, since God, by definition, must exist. And therefore, all thought refers to what is actual, what God has done, or what is possible, what God can do. Therefore, a dipolar being exists, and that is what we call God. Now, that is an unsound argument, because he just assumes in the argument what he's trying to prove. It may be true that all thoughts refer to something either actual or possible, but how does he know that God has to necessarily exist? And even if the concept of God is that God must necessarily exist, how does he know that that concept has been instantiated in reality? Hartshorne has metaphysical differences from other process theists. For example, he says that contrary to Whitehead, God is actually a society of actual entities. So there's a kind of polytheistic brand of panentheism. And he says God is a cosmic mind resident in the cosmos, and says a mind is made up of thoughts. God is a society of those thoughts or entities. Also, for Whitehead, God is impermanent, just like the world. But for Hartshorne, God is the logically necessary ground for understanding impermanent things. Cobb also disagrees with Whitehead's assertion that all action is grounded in God. He says that's too deterministic. Rather, all action originates from each new occasion and is completely grounded in that new moment of actualization. Okay, here's some common elements among panentheists. First, they all embraced an event rather than a substantival metaphysic. By event metaphysic, there are no things, they're just events. So the most important insight of the process theists is taken right out of Buddhism. There are no enduring substances. Reality is composed of events and not things. While Bertrand Russell was certainly no process theist, nor was he a Buddhist, he summarizes event metaphysics well when he writes that matter is simply a way of grouping events. Some events belong to groups that can be regarded as material things. Others, such as light waves, do not. It is the events that are the stuff of the world, and each of them is of brief duration. We are all, according to both Buddhists and panentheists, events of only brief duration. If God exists, then he is an event of brief duration as well. Whatever survives God is not the same as what was before, but rather a new event which further realizes God's primordial nature. Bipolar or dipolar panentheism. All process believe that God is two poles or natures, a concrete or realized nature and a primordial or deficiently actual nature. In short, the world is God's concrete nature, or the ideals within God's mind are his primordial nature. Creation ex hulos, God creates out of something already there. Because the universe is eternal, he has to direct the world. He doesn't create the world. And codependence. Remember Whitehead's claim. It is as true to say that God creates the world as it is that the world creates God. If there were no world, there could be no God. And if there were no God, there would be no world. How are we doing?
Okay. This is a bit up here, but we're working through it.
So I know that I went fast, but do you get the general picture? God is the soul of the world. He's evolving with the world. The God that was yesterday is not the same God as today. Everything is brief, short, and permanent, and is always moving into something new. And there are no things. Do not be deceived by your picture view of reality where you have pictures of things in your mind, and you're just trying to hold on to that as a permanent thing. Really, everything that you're encountering is passing away.
I'm a little confused on the whole idea of it said, I think, earlier, something about a God. God has the potential to become infinite, and yet he will always be finite. I don't really understand that.
It would be kind of like saying that Travis Campbell has the potential to be the greatest basketball player, but he will only always be just a decent basketball player.
Okay.
That's the best I can do with it.
Is that it? Okay. I have to go back and look at my notes. Isn't there some correspondence between that and pantheism yesterday, talking about potential?
Yeah.
Okay. Anyways.
They want to grant potentiality in the world, whereas the pantheist wants to say, any potentiality I encounter is illusion. Now, of course, they beg the question when they say that. How do you know that that's an illusion? But that's what they want to say. Here's a positive word about each of these worldviews separately. Concerning Buddhism, one cannot help but stand in awe of the spiritual wisdom and insights that have been exemplified by its disciples since Buddha appeared on the scene. Buddhaghosa, the Dalai Lama, and a host of others have taught us wisdom, exemplified serenity, and encouraged peace far more than most other philosophies one can consider. We must be especially appreciative of the practical nature of Buddhism. Buddha did not ask his followers to sit around and speculate about metaphysical realities which may or may not exist and which may be irrelevant to our lives. He encouraged his disciples, and by extension all of us, to seek a solution to the greatest problem facing the human race, death and suffering. And there can be little doubt that Buddha's chief diagnosis was correct. It is true that death is stalking all of us, and it is a shame that so many of us go merrily our way without giving the inevitability of our own personal death so much as a thought. Finally, we appreciate the fact that Buddha upheld the basic laws of human rationality, embraced the basic reliability of the senses, and encouraged a simple and common sense approach to life. The Buddhist is the first to open his own outlook to an internal critique, and he refuses to hide behind lame platitudes, such as the laws of logic are not the same between East and West, or God or the gods need not be evaluated by the laws of logic, or if this is true for me, then it's right. And so if I choose to believe it, I'm exonerated from any kind of criticism. He doesn't do that. He's not a wimp. Buddhists rightly recognize that this sort of thinking is a pathetic attempt to just save yourself. Like Aristotle, who flourished almost 200 years after his death, Buddha embraced the correspondence theory of truth, saying, when in fact there is a next world, if the belief occurs to me that there is no next world, that would be a false belief. And when in fact there is a next world, and one asserts the statement that there is no next world, that would be a false statement. And when in fact there is a next world, the belief occurs to me that there is a next world, that would be a true statement. And the Buddhist tradition as a whole opens itself to rational criticism. Gunapala Dharmasiri, a Buddhist philosopher, says this. He says, Buddhism emphasizes the necessity of rational understanding, experience, and verification in the field of religion. So far, the history of humanity has shown that in all and every branch of knowledge, it has always been rational knowledge and rational experience that have led humanity to progress. There is absolutely no reason why they should be undervalued only in the field of religion. Therefore, the progress of religion and humanity also necessarily depends on the pursuance of rational experience that results in wisdom. The process theist is also to be thanked, for he has raised a number of concerns that any philosophically prodigious person must consider while developing and articulating his own understanding of the divine. First, process theists rightly insist that if God is to be experientially relevant to us, he must be someone we can relate to. He cannot be merely a metaphysical principle explained in the world, but he must be a personal being who relates to us and we to him. Second, process theists, along with their Buddhist predecessors, rightly emphasize the fact that we live in a world of change, insubstantiality, and discontinuity. As one theist put it long ago, you are just a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away. Third, the panentheists are correct in their desire to articulate and defend a comprehensive world and life view. And fourth, process theists have helpfully defended a version of the ontological argument for God's existence. Indeed, even if one concludes that the argument is unsound, as we just showed that it was, you have to admit that the argument has long aided analytical minds to discern what is and is not possible. And finally, process theists have given an improvement to pantheism, for they have tried to draw some distinction between God and the world. Hmm. All right, how are we doing?
Good.
We can't be process theists. You know why?
Why?
It's absolutely impossible for process theism to be true. And I've listened to process theists in these debates, and they get their asses handed to them all the time. It's not even funny. It's not even close. Process theists will constantly say, well, yeah, that's just kind of like the way you look at it, but if you just kind of get out of your system over here and come into our system and look at it this way, then, you know, it's just a different way of looking at the world. No, it's not just a different way of looking at the world. It's an irrational way of looking at the world. It can't be true. Why? Why would I say something so mean and cruel? Because panentheism says that God is self-caused. And if you look on page 95, I illustrate the point in the following diagram. Remember Whitehead's claim? Yeah. It is as true to say that God creates the world as that the world creates God. So notice you have this system here. God creates the world, nature, and then the world creates God. That's a self-caused system. That's a self-caused loop. And nothing can be self-caused. Nothing can be self-caused. You can't exist before you exist. You can't be something that needs a cause only to be the cause you need. If you really needed a cause, you couldn't be the cause you need. And if you are the cause you need, then you don't need a cause.
So,
boom, done. I mean, really don't have to say anything else, do we? 2 seconds. And by the way, look, I'm telling you.
They have to know this, right? So,
I don't know. It drives me crazy when, because this is the most irrational philosophy I've ever encountered, process theology. And yet it is embraced by the vast majority of liberal theologians.
Now, this is separate from Buddhism.
Yeah, it's separate from Buddhism.
Okay. It's just the process.
Buddhism has a similar.
Takes much of their principles, for the principles of Buddhism, and
yes,
applies them to this system. But at the very heart of it, this is their structure.
This is process theology.
God creates the world as the world is creating God.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that is absurd.
So I was kind of, maybe what I was getting at earlier is the universe has always been eternal in their system, correct? The universe
mm-hmm.
is always eternal. But then where did God come from? Because at some point there had to be an event where the world was created and God was created as well, right? So there had to be a cause to God, because if he didn't exist and he's always changing, there had to be a point at which that became true. There had to be a point at which he started changing, right?
Yeah, if you look at number 2 here, you're actually raising the very point I raised. Again, I mean, I'm commending you for your intuitions. You have this look on your face a lot of the time in these lectures like, you're lost. There are 2 kinds of lostness, okay? There are 2 types of confusion. One confusion is there. Some people are confused because they just don't know what the heck is going on. You know, they just plain don't understand the issues. And then some people are confused because they're thinking logically, and the system that they're analyzing is running up against their logic. and I think that you're the latter. So when I think that what's happening to you is you're hearing some of this and you're like, that doesn't make any sense. Now, you have to go with it, though. You have to try your best to fully understand it. And so, like, when you're on your own, when you leave this course and you're studying this stuff yourself, pick up a book by a process theologian and try to sort of divorce, and it's hard to do, but divorce it. You can say, maybe Travis Campbell didn't read this rightly, right? And then read it as carefully as you can, and then sit back and then say, okay, did they overcome what are considered the standard criticisms of process theology?
Yeah, well, take for example, monism, which when I left, I was, you know, my mind obviously was in turmoil. And you asked if I wanted a hint, and I said no, because I wanted to think about it for myself.
Right.
But I had no clue that ultimately what would come to defeat that is the option of potential in that, you know, linear argument. Mm-hmm. And I didn't come to that, you know, revelation on my own. So, you know, that maybe I'm a little worried about that. Is this getting out there? And that,
right.
Because obviously I do have the wisdom of the teacher to rely on in this case. Because as much as I'm stating that, what I just said that you're saying is the second argument, as much as I'm stating that, I'm also relying on you to affirm that that is true.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. At one point, the student will become as wise as the teacher and will move on, right? At one point, that will happen. And you need to read these books for yourself. You need to analyze this on your own. You need to create your own critique. And I will say that the first person that ever walked me through this, I read through some of Norman Geiser's writings and some of Ronald Nash's writings. And then when I went and started reading this stuff for myself and then seeing how the process theists try to overcome the objection. You don't overcome an objection by not answering it. Mm-hmm. Nor do you overcome the objection by saying, well, this is just my way of seeing things, or this is just a different point of view.
And if you could enter into the sphere, you would understand it.
Yeah, and that doesn't work because Geiser did enter into the sphere. I saw Geiser, I listened to a debate between Geiser and Cobb. And I don't think Geiser's the greatest philosopher in the world, and he has a lot of problems with his own theology. I mean, it's interesting how such a rational mind that can produce a philosophy of religion text can turn around and produce such a horrible book like Chosen But Free, which is his critique of Calvinist predestination. It's a horrible book. I mean, I bet any Arminian would tell you that. That agrees with this conclusion. It's just not good. So, but Geiser, to his credit, did enter into the panentheistic worldview, and that was the problem. I've entered into your worldview, and it's falling apart. It's shattering itself. And so the second point, what I'm saying here, this is another way to make the point that I just made. The point is, you can't have a self-caused anything. You can't have a self-caused system. You can't have a self-caused person or deity or whatever. So when the two children are on the playground and one says, God created everything, and the other one says, well, who created God? And the child responds, well, God made himself. That is false. That can't be true. That is illogical. So another way to put it, and this is kind of what you were trying to say, how does God actualize his own potential to exist? Because potentials cannot actualize themselves. If you have a bucket, and that bucket is empty, and then you come back the next day and you see that there's water in there, the mere potential of the bucket to be filled with water does not explain why it is, right? Either someone or something filled it up with water. It either rained, or someone, you know, turn on a hose and filled it up with water. Go ahead.
Okay, well, now this is an interesting point. So the bucket then, its potential is realized by the rain. Well, that is something that it's outside of itself that it has really no influence over. Could a process theologian argue that the universe fulfills the potential of God. And that, in other words, God is...
That's what they're trying to say.
The God is the bucket, and the universe, as being eternal and always existing, fulfills the potential of God to create this world that then creates himself.
Yeah, yeah.
You're still having an event. You still have to reconcile that there was an event at some point where this God comes into being, but that his potential, you could say, always existed, and the fact that the universe is eternal, and because God needs the world and the world needs God, that ultimately his potential is fulfilled by the universe.
That, yeah, that's what they're trying to say. And in a sense, their answer depersonalizes God, so it's no longer a God I can relate to. The God really just becomes the ideals that the universe is evolving towards. Now, the question is, who's evolving it? Well, it's not anything sovereign over the universe. And if you say it's the soul of the universe, then the question is, well, how did that soul come into being? And all the questions that you just raised. Now, sometimes, to save this whole collapse, process theists have said, well, creativity. Creativity explains all of this. What is creativity? Well, you're either going to say creativity is something that is beyond this whole self-caused system, or it's just a part of it. If it's just a part of it, you haven't explained anything. And if it's beyond it, then that becomes your God substitute.
Creativity is the God.
Creativity becomes God, yeah.
But then what?
Here's an illustration.
Yeah.
I jump out of an airplane. I'm going, you know, and I don't have a parachute. And the question is, am I going to land safely on the ground? And someone says, sure, because look at Nathan over there. He's falling, too. And I fly kind of like James Bond in one of his movies. He flew and landed on this guy and stole his parachute. Well, I fly up to you, and I grab onto you, and lo and behold, you don't have a parachute either. And then we look over, and there's John Albino. He's fallen out of the sky, too. And so we fly over to him, and then we fly to, and then the three of us, John Albino, he doesn't have a parachute. So John Albino, Travis Campbell, and Nathan fly over to Jeremiah Pitts, who doesn't have a parachute. And next thing you know, there's 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 of us, and we're all in a big circle. And the question is, how are we going to land safely? Now, you can't say Travis Campbell is going to himself keep this whole circle from landing and falling to its death. Because if I myself could have done it, I could have done it without you. Well, spreading the problem out to different people doesn't solve the problem. Right? If I can't be self-caused in this sense, keeping myself from being killed by gravity, then I can't be helped by a bunch of other people who themselves can't keep themselves from being killed by gravity either. You can't have a self-caused loop of things. And so you can't say, well, my potential to not fall can sort of be in a boomerang that explains somehow their potential not to fall, and that will somehow become magically actual. So that right before we hit the ground, we're just going to go stop falling altogether and just sort of float to the earth. You know that's not going to happen. The whole bunch of us, whether it's 10 or 10 million, we're all going to fall to our deaths. And adding more potentials to the equation doesn't help one bit. Okay. All right. Let's move on to the fourth point. This is on page 96, near the bottom of the page. An event metaphysic embraced by both Buddhists and Panentheists, so this is a criticism that would apply to both, is self-defeating. Several insights make this clear. The principle of dukkha, the principle that everything changes, all is in process or all is impermanent, cannot be proven. Indeed, the simple fact that everything I observe is changing is no proof that everything changes. No experience is infinite, as we have seen. Therefore, no experience of any kind, regardless of how many times it is confirmed, can guarantee it that it's universal. Buddha was right to say that some, many, or even most experiences are illustrations of the impermanence of our existence. But when he went the next mile and said that everything is impermanent, he made a leap that is not in principle knowable. At best, dukkha is reasonable, but it can never be known as the truth, let alone the absolute truth. But it gets worse. It gets worse for the Buddhist and the panentheist. For it turns out that the assertion all is impermanent is not even reasonable. Now, I want you to look at that statement. And I give a very elaborate argument on page 97 just showing how self-defeating this is. But let's just go to the skinny of this. Look at the statement all is impermanent and ask the following question. Is the truth of that statement permanent?
Well, it can't be. If all, which is all-encompassing and includes everything.
Okay, so let's say
permanent, then there is nothing that is permanent.
Well, if you say all is impermanent, and if I say is that statement permanently true?
You're self-defeating.
It's self-defeating. If you say no, well, then that means that something becomes permanent. And if you say yes, it is permanently true, then we found our permanent truth, namely that all is impermanent. So Buddhism embraces a self-defeating worldview. And that's this very long argument that I give, and if you want to study it, you can. But what I do in that long argument is really just making that point. The statement that all is changing is self-defeating because it is not a changing truth. Or it is offered as an absolute truth, in which case it is a non-changing truth, and therefore it is not the case that all is changing.
And this all is impermanent is directly from, and this is what they... This
that's
what
dukkha. They, that's the first noble truth. It's not very noble because it's not very true. All is impermanent. At the bottom of page 97, I say this, an event metaphysic which reduces all persons to non-substantial no-selves that do not endure through time is self-defeating, since the assertion, I do not exist, is self-defeating, nor is the statement, the memories I have as an 8-year-old boy are not mine, affirmable, because if I have them, then they are mine. Here's basically what the Buddhist is saying, and this is what the panentheist is saying. The person who began the sentence is not the same person who ends the sentence. In just this moment, a whole new Travis Campbell has emerged. At each fleeting moment, impermanence is so real that there's literally no I that endures through time, and therefore the person you see before you is constantly changing to where there's a whole new person being created each moment.
You're saying that's not, you can't prove that, or it's not knowable.
It's not knowable and it's self-defeating. Because that would mean that I can't even say I spoke the words that I spoke just a minute ago. You basically have to deny the reliability of all your memories.
And do they?
No.
They don't deny memories.
They don't deny memories. They say that is an ancestor self that had those memories. I'm a descendant of that. I've inherited those memories from my ancestor self.
A memory of a sentence that you said 2 minutes ago.
Yeah, and we can have really fun when we start talking about court laws, court cases. I can say, I didn't commit the crime, Your Honor, my ancestor self did. And given the event metaphysic of the Buddhist, he should buy that. He should say, oh, well, I guess you're free then.
Which is not livable.
It's not livable. I quote Hartshorne here. He says, no ego is ever literally conscious of itself. The self now is the individual subject actually enjoying the present consciousness. Later selves will enjoy it so far as they remember it. Past selves did enjoy it insofar as they anticipated it. Any timelessly the same self, birth to death, is a mere abstraction. It does not literally do or know anything. Buddhaghosa, mere suffering exists, but no sufferer is found. The deeds are, but no doer is found. Grundler is a theologian who used to be a process theist, and he couldn't escape these problems, and so he abandoned the system. And he wrote a critique of process theology called The Inexhaustible God. It's a great book. And here's what he says in this book. He says, surely this will not do. In other words, the statements of Hartshorne and Buddhaghosa, that's not going to fly. He says, if there is no sense in which the self is a contiguous and continuous identity over its tenure of life, other than as an abstraction that does not literally do or know anything, then we can only speak of an I series of unrelated actual occasions. What accounts for the identity of the self in the sense of the transcendence of the ego? A remark made not so long ago in my presence by a prominent process theologian illustrates the uncertain doctrine of the school. I look inside myself, he observed, and find only the process of change. I see no changeless substance called the ego or the soul. And my question was, who is the I who is doing the looking on at myself in that process? There is an ordered continuity in the self that is more than the mere chance collocations of atoms or monads from which consciousness finally supervenes. The personal pronoun I is something we legitimately use for a lifetime in spite of the continual metabolism of the body. It does not help to call this I or ego a mere abstraction from a series of self-nows, when the point in question is how a series of self-nows is related in continuity so as to enable the processing self to refer to himself in some sense as the same today as he was yesterday. The fact that both process theism and Buddhism deny the undeniable fact of an enduring self is alone sufficient to render the worldviews false. But there's yet another point to be raised in connection with this one, meaning, and I brought this up just a minute ago, Buddhism and pantheism make human responsibility meaningless. That's the point that I bring out here. You can't say that I'm responsible for my actions if everything you do is all the consequences are going to be inherited by a later person. By the way, Buddhist reincarnationism helps out with the idea of memory of incarnations. They really overcome that objection only to land in even more hot water, because if it's not me that inherits the karma but by fourth aggregate, why should I care about that guy? I can just live it up now because I'm going to perish in the moment. I will not survive the moment, let alone my death. So karmic death, who cares?
But wouldn't they say that that goes against the denial of self and suffering? Right? So that would be your responsibility then, wouldn't it?
Well, if a Buddhist comes to me and says, hey, look, you need to abandon the false notion of self, I'll say, who are you talking to? There is no me to abandon this notion of self, so asking me to do that is irrational, given your system.
Do you think Buddhists do ask, or do you think...
No, I don't think... My experience with Buddhists, I've hung out with Buddhists not more than I want to. I want to hang out with more, so I haven't hung out with as many as I want to, is what I meant to say. But the few Buddhists that I've hung out with and talked to about this stuff, they just laugh off those problems. They don't really want to enter into dialogue with you on the serious problems inherent in their worldview. That's been my experience. In fact, I'm kind of a lesser being because I'm Western, and I don't really understand, and they kind of look at me as cute. And it's kind of condescending, you know. And I'm like, well, that no self over there that's looking at me condescendingly is kind of being a jerk right now. You know? That's been my experience.
No self.
Let's go to the fifth point. I do point out that panentheism and Buddhism are religiously inadequate. As we noted in our critique of panentheism, a worldview is religiously inadequate if it offers an I-thou relationship between creatures as well as between creator and creature. But according to process theology, God is not a continuing I over time, but becomes ever new in the present moment. And the same can be said about humans. This renders a real relationship between humans and God impossible, for no one lasts long enough to have anything like a meaningful relationship with another person or entity. It gets worse than this. For process theists generally agree that the only way human freedom can be preserved is if they are sealed off from God's present vision. In other words, process theists deny that at the moment a human makes a choice, God is observing the choice being made. Whitehead did not say this, since he maintained that our choices are somehow dependent upon God, but his followers have well understood that his view takes away from human autonomy. And so Hartshorne, Cobb, and Griffin have all asserted that our choices are independent of God. In the words of Griffin, it is necessarily the case that God cannot completely control the creatures. if God is watching my every move, then to the extent that I'm conscious of that, to the same extent I lose my sense of freedom. I am not free if there is always someone there watching and judging me. Recall Jean-Paul Sartre's hatred of going to a Parisian restaurant because of the stares he got from various people. And so in order to preserve human autonomy, God has sealed himself off from our present moment and allows us to act independently of him. But notice also that I do not survive the moment. There is no enduring I. So what does God experience about us? It is not our future. That doesn't exist. And God does not know the future, for such knowledge would also destroy human freedom and autonomy. God cannot experience our present while we are making our decisions, for that too would destroy our freedom. The only thing God left for God to experience is the past. Like Bilbo and Frodo Baggins, who wore a ring that could make them invisible, so also we autonomous creatures wear a ring of autonomy that makes us in the present moment of choice invisible to God. After we have made our decisions and chosen from several possibilities while wearing the ring of invisibility, then and only then are we willing to take off the ring and let our finished acts and words appear visibly before God. And yet, Grunler concludes, if God never knows us as we really are in our lively moments of experiencing and choosing because we have on the ring, then what he finally sees when we take it off is not our complete self. The past he sees is minus all that former vitality of the living self. All he sees is a dead shell, a chambered nautilus. Everything vital has been lost forever. God can't remember it because he can't see it. Our demand to be free on our own terms has brought upon us the bane of the ring wearers. It is indeed a tragic vision. And Buddhism is the same way. You'll notice that if you go to most countries, like go to Thailand, I was there last year, Theravada Buddhism is the heart of the Buddhism in Thailand, and yet most of them go and worship Buddha as God. I married into a Buddhist family. And my mother-in-law, bless her heart, told me one time that she believes that we have a soul. Well, I said, but Buddha said there is no soul. Well, that doesn't matter. They don't care what Buddha said. His teachings are irrelevant to most people. And so as Corjuan says on page 103, he's summarizing the problem here. He says in the middle of that quote there, he goes, nothing infuriates a knowledgeable Buddhist more than asserting that Buddhists worship the Buddha as a god. Yet on the level of the lay people, this is precisely what does take place. And a lay person may not be embarrassed to tell you. Of course, this development is not surprising. The hope of nirvana in some distant incarnation is not sufficient to help people with the stresses of daily life. When a child becomes ill, when the crops fail, and when a loved one dies, the human religious impulse demands some immediate spiritual assistance. Consequently, lay people either reinterpret Buddhist practices to supply them with the need of spiritual help or incorporate non-Buddhist elements into their religion or both. I don't think Buddhism or pantheism helps us deal with the problem of evil and suffering. How is God going to really help us in suffering if God is a non-substantial no-self that can't even endure the moment? How can I trust in such a God? I could pity that God. I can love that God. But I can't really trust in that God to help defeat evil. And does Buddhism really deal with suffering either? I point out on page 104, the Buddhist reason that suffering comes through attachment and the feeling of attachment I may have for something comes about because I assume that I'm an enduring ego that needs to be fed. But there are several problems with this line of reasoning. First, it assumes that the suffering will end once enlightenment is reached. Yet even Buddha himself suffered and died from food poisoning. Suffering in this life does not end with the realization that I am a no self. Second of all, it assumes that suffering will end once this life is over. But maybe I, or a series of ancestor selves, will continue to survive into eternity. How do you know? And three, while the desire to divorce oneself from attachments is often noble, such a stance can sometimes be unhealthy and even immoral. On the Buddhist model, the simple act of going to the doctor to relieve pain could be interpreted as a sign that one sees oneself as an enduring I. Does such activity incur karmic debt? When a father weeps over the loss of his daughter, he is weeping for both himself and her. Such an act also presupposes an enduring I. Should not the Buddhists frown upon such activity? And how would that not be immoral if you did? They're unable to give us a hope for a better tomorrow. I mean, this system cannot help you in the future. And finally, is there really a difference? Well, the eighth point I want to make, is there really a difference between pantheism and panentheism? Here's a quotation from Hartshorne. He says, "Co-relativism or surrelativism and pantheism are logically the same doctrine with only a difference in emphasis." He's basically saying, we're saying the world is God's body. So the world is God. And the pantheist is saying that the world is God. They're just giving an unqualified statement about that, and we're just qualifying it a little bit. But what really is the difference? And if there really is no difference, then all the things I said against pantheism begin to apply to panentheism. Finally, the God of prosthesism is not the God of the Bible. This is an important point for those who say they're Christians, but they want to believe in prosthesism. On page 106, I give scriptures which constantly say that the God of the Bible is self-existent, uncreated, and independent of the world process. And so if you say you're a Christian but you believe this, you basically excommunicate the entire Christian community. And I would say that that's disingenuous. That's irrational and actually dishonest for you to say such a thing. Now, if you'll bear with me, I'm going to close out. So I just have a minute. Buddha himself said there is no God of any kind. He actually stated that there is neither a recluse nor a Brahman who at one and the same time can know all and can see all. The situation does not exist. Yeah, that's a good question. How does he know that? Given his philosophy, that's true, but we've already shown that his philosophy has big problems, not to mention it's self-defeating. When one reads through Buddhist literature, one can immediately realize that for the Buddhists, God is simply irrelevant for the attainment of nirvana. God is an idea we can do without. According to Buddhism, our ideas of God and soul are false and empty, says Rahula. Compare Buddha's attitude concerning the relationship between suffering, worry, serenity, and God with that of Jesus of Nazareth. And here's what Jesus said. He said, "Therefore I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat or what you will drink." So you're having insurance problems with your car. I'm having health insurance problems. And we're, you know, you and I stress out about it. And Jesus is saying, don't worry about all that. Is life not more than food and the body more than clothing? Look at the birds of the air. They neither sow nor reap nor gather into barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not more valuable than they? And can you, by worrying, add a single hour to your span of life? And why do you worry about clothing? Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They neither toil nor spin. Yet I tell you, even Solomon in all of his glory was not clothed like one of these. But if God so clothes the grass of the field, which is alive today and tomorrow thrown into the oven, will he not much more, all the more, clothe you, you of little faith? Therefore, do not worry, saying, what will we eat, or what will we drink, or what will we wear? For it is the Gentiles who strive for all these things, and indeed your heavenly Father knows that you need all these things. But strive first for the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you. So do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will bring worries of its own. Today's trouble is enough for today. We have here in this very simple yet profound and indeed hard-to-follow passage Jesus' own take on what Buddhists call right concentration. Concentrate on the day's task and don't worry about tomorrow. With the Buddha, Jesus insists that we are to live in the now. With Buddha, Jesus is telling us that we are to live serenely, peacefully. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. And faithfully, we're to live faithfully in this world. But notice also that Jesus anchors his exhortation and the context of a worldview that A, offers hope to those who are suffering. Indeed, A, even though life is often terrible, we are to know that there's a Heavenly Father who takes care of us on a daily basis. For if God takes care of the natural elements of our world, how much more will he take care of us as children? Also, Jesus' words do not appeal to the counterintuitive notions that there is no God and that human beings are insubstantial no-selves. We must ask the question frankly, which doctrine should we follow? That of a man who rejected the two most basic beliefs that humans have ever entertained, replacing them with speculations that are incoherent, or that of a man who refined those basic beliefs into a doctrine that is nothing short of sublime? I think that by asking the question, we have answered it. Both panentheism and Buddhism, while proclaiming much that is good and true, are false views of reality. Process theism postulates a self-caused God who has nothing to do with the God of the Bible, while Buddhism and panentheism are both self-defeating, incoherent, and religiously inadequate. Indeed, since panentheism is really pantheism in disguise, and since pantheism is in turn atheism in disguise, we find ourselves confronted with only two worldviews, not four. Same could be said about Buddhism. And so that brings us down to two.